Thank you very much. I would like to tell you about some work in progress I'm doing with Oleg Evnin and with Anatoly Konechny. And the starting point is just standard perturbative string theory. So what does one do in perturbative string theory? One computes an S matrix using conformal field theory techniques. So here's some stringy generalization of Feynman diagrams. And if the external states are taken to infinity, as one does to compute an S matrix, one can conformally map these semi-infinite tubes into points, and one gets a sum over Riemann surfaces with insertions of local vertex operators, and those one can compute using the standard machinery. Now, one important point about this formalism that it requires asymptotic regions so that you can define an S matrix. So then you can ask what happens if our space doesn't have asymptotic regions, for instance, if we have a completely compact space times a time direction. So let's, for concreteness, focus on a torus. You don't have asymptotic regions, so there's no S matrix. And one can ask, can we compute how strings interact in such a space? Now, if you don't know about string theory, this might sound like a very trivial question. Of course, if you know how the S matrix works, there should be some local description of the physics one would expect, but it turns out to be a very difficult question. The first thing that goes wrong if you do the naive thing and apply the formulas you would usually use, just imposing periodicity of space-time directions, is that you find infrared divergences which invalidates the perturbation theory. And the goal of this work will be to propose natural observables that are free from such divergences and see exactly how that happens. So to give you just one physics motivation for this, there is a framework called string gas cosmology, which attempts to explain why our universe has three large dimensions and the other dimensions are unobservably small. I won't say very much about it, but the ingredients are that you start with a space that is entirely compact, for instance, a 9 torus. You introduce both momentum and winding modes, so this is a stringy ingredient. The winding modes have negative pressure, the momentum modes have positive pressure, and you assume that you start in some state with equal numbers of both so that the total pressure vanishes. Then there would be some thermal fluctuation that makes some of the dimensions fluctuate to larger size. And if the winding modes around those larger dimensions were to annihilate, those dimensions would be allowed to expand because there's no winding modes left to keep them small. And those could become the three large dimensions. And then there are arguments based on the probability that two strings intersect in a given number of dimensions, that three would be a preferred dimension. So this is obviously, would obviously be a nice thing to have. Now the problem with this formalism is that the equations to study the initial regime where you have a torus of string scale size and with stringy temperatures are just unknown. So developing a formalism for doing string theory in such backgrounds will be a first step in improving on this situation. Now, this is an old problem that could have been formulated long ago. So why are we revisiting it now? Well, the motivation is an analogy with a slightly simpler but still similar problem, namely that of the recoil of D0 brains. What are D0 brains? Well, they are some massive localized objects in string theory. And the way they are usually introduced in conformal field theory is as a locus, for instance, the origin of space, where open strings are allowed to end. And the open strings would encode the degrees of freedom of those particles. Now, if you compute string loop corrections to this picture, what you find is that these D0 brains, which you introduced as static, are really dynamical objects, and they have a mass that is very large, namely it goes like 1 over G string in string scale units. And we'll always be working in a perturbative regime where the string coupling is assumed to be small compared to 1. Now, given those D particles, the zero brains, you can scatter strings of them and ask what happens. So this is a situation. We have this static particle. We scatter a string of it. Now, if you do tree-level classical computations, you find well-defined results. There's no problem. And the intuition for that is that your D0 brain can stay at the same place even though it absorbs momentum. And the reason is that in this approximation, it's infinitely massive, so it won't move if you hit it with something. However, when you compute the first loop correction, which would be the annulus diagram, then you find a divergence, an infrared divergence that tells you that the perturbation theory is not good. So in general, if you find infrared divergences, it signals that you're asking the wrong question. For instance, one thing you might be doing is expanding around the background that's really not close to the real system, to the back-reacted system. And that's indeed the case here. If you have this massive particle and you hit it with something to give it some momentum, then it will start moving. And even though this velocity might be small, if you wait long enough, your D0 brain will be far away from where you thought it would be by looking at the original background you expanded around. So this is intuitively very clear, but the problem is how do you incorporate this in string theory so that you really can do loop corrections in a systematic way in the theory. And this turns out not to be completely trivial. I will first give you an overview of what I'm going to explain in a bit more detail for those of you interested in the details. The others can just do with the overview and then skip a little technical part and then get back to me. So I will first explain exactly how this infrared divergence occurs, and that is most easy to see in the so-called Plumbing fixture construction, which I'll introduce. And then the question will be how to cure this divergence. The first thing that one can try, and that was tried in the past, is to start from a background where the D0 brain is not just static, but starts moving at some moment of time, but I'll argue that this approach is not satisfactory. The approach that I will claim gives better results is the so-called world line formalism, where one explicitly integrates over the various possible world lines of a D0 brain. And what I will argue is that the resulting classical disk divergence arises, which precisely cancels the annulus divergence that we had before, so that the perturbation theory is finite at least to leading non-trivial order. So now I'll give a few details of what I said here. So what is this Plumbing fixture formula? Well, the idea is quite simple. If you have an annulus diagram, it's a one-loop diagram in space-time, you can view it as a disk diagram, so a diagram without loops, with some strip added to it to create the loop. Then you can cut open the path integral over this strip and insert a complete set of states. And if you do that, you can write the annulus diagram as a sum over all possible intermediate states of an amplitude on the disk with two extra vertex operators inserted. And then there is this propagator that denotes the propagation of this intermediate state, which is written in some Schwinger parameterization-like way over here. So the V alpha run over a complete set of local operators, and Q is a gluing parameter, which is the modulus of the annulus. And you can think of it as some sort of Schwinger parameter. So now let's focus on the region where this gluing parameter is small. And physically, that's the region where the annulus develops a long, thin strip. And in this regime, you're dominated by the term with the smallest conformal dimension, H alpha. And if I ignore tachyons, so for instance, if I look at the superstring, then the lowest dimension modes would be a massless translation mode, which is the Goldstone mode, because the D0 brain breaks translation invariance. You can compute this divergence. So this we've seen already. The lightest modes are these, and the conformal dimension is this. If you plug it in, you find this integral. These vertex operators, when you integrate them over the boundary of the disk, will just give you the total momentum that these closed string states give the D0 brain. And in the end, you have some integral left. And well, this is essentially, if you did the integrals in a different order, this would be the integral over all frequencies of 1 over omega squared. That's clearly something that is divergence. If you introduce a cutoff on this modular parameter, what you find is that you have a divergence that goes like the square root log of this cutoff. This blows up when epsilon goes to zero, and that's the infrared divergence I was mentioning. So physically, it's just a massless particle that runs in a loop, and if you are only in 0 plus 1 dimensions, that gives you an infinity. Okay, so what to do about it? So what was tried soon after the discovery of deep brains, among other attempts, was to deform this conformal field theory with some local operator. And this local operator just tells you that the D0 brain is not sitting at the origin for all times, but that it sits at the origin till a certain time, x not equals 0, and then it starts moving with a constant velocity. And if you choose that velocity to be the correct one that you would get based on momentum conservation, then indeed such an insertion would cancel the annulus divergence. More precisely, it would give rise to a divergence on the disk, because this by itself would break conformal invariance. And this divergence would precisely cancel the one from the annulus divergence. Now, still, this approach is not satisfactory in the sense that the closed strings with which you're hitting the D0 brain can be chosen to be in momentum eigenstates. That's what's chosen here. And in that case, there is no preferred moment of impact. So there is no reason to say that your D brain will start moving at time equals 0 as opposed to any other time. And indeed, all these possible choices for the time would cancel divergences, but the finite part of the amplitude that remains would depend on the time you arbitrarily chose. This is clearly not, yes.
So how about continental radius?
Pardon?
How about continental radius?
Sorry, say it again.
How about curve that is continental radius?
How about a radiant trajectory? Well, that's not what you would expect, right? If you have a particle somewhere and you hit it with something, it will start moving with some constant velocity. Okay, but in the end, after this ended, the particle, yeah, so that could be, but then you would still have to decide, like, when will it start moving, et cetera. I don't know if there's, I'll show you what we think happens, or what we believe happens, and then we can discuss it again if still useful. Okay, so here is the proposal which we think is a better way of dealing with it. And that is to introduce these dynamical world lines for the D0 brain and to do a path integral over them. So in this formalism, you start with the D0 brain world line and you parameterize it with some proper time t. This world line is embedded in space-time. The world sheet of an open string is also embedded in the space-time. The boundary points of the open string have to lie on the D0 brain and are, of course, part of this world sheet, and everything has to be consistent. So then you do path integrals over the world lines of the D0 brains. That's the new ingredient in the formalism, over the various embeddings of the boundary on the D0 brain, over the string coordinates, the embedding of the string in space-time. This is completely standard. And you have the constraint that if you go this way or this way, it should give you the same point in space-time. And then you can write a proposal for the amplitude for the D0 brain to move from some position x1 to position x2 while it absorbs or emits a number of closed string states. So let's discuss this formula in a little bit detail. So it's a sum over all possible topologies of the world sheet. This is just the space-time loop expansion. It's weighted by the Euler number, as usual in string theory. There's integrated vertex operators. This is also standard string theory. For technical convenience, we work in Euclidean space-time. In general, there should be an integration over moduli if you work in higher genus. And then there's another technical detail, which I won't go into. And if you have this formula, then you can convert it into a scattering amplitude for your D0 brain to come in with a certain momentum, to leave with a certain momentum, and to absorb and emit closed strings in the process. So this is some reduction formula that would give you this amplitude for transition from momentum P1 to P2 for the D0 brain while absorbing and emitting closed strings labeled by this momentum. Okay, so it's non-trivial to compute this path integral, but well, my collaborator Oleg Avnin developed techniques to do this perturbatively, so assuming the string coupling is small. And then we applied this a number of years ago to this problem of the zero brain recoil. And what one finds after an elaborate computation is that there is a disk divergence that arises from fluctuations of the zero brain world line. And it precisely and automatically cancels the annulus divergence, all coefficients included, provided that one makes a very natural identification of a short distance cutoff on the disk world sheet and the cutoff on the long strip, on the modular parameter of the strip. And it turns out that this computation in the world line formalism, that the result of it is equivalent to deforming the CFT with a bilocal operator. So instead of doing this world line formalism, I could do the standard CFT, but deforming it with this bilocal operator, where what we call G kick here is just the Green function for a massive particle. And what you see is that this operator is bilocal, and that's a big difference with the local operators that were introduced before. And the intuition for this is that this derivative of this normal derivative of xi is a momentum density. So intuitively, we know that if you give a certain momentum, then the brain will get a certain velocity because of it that is proportional to it. So this momentum will give you a displacement of the brain that takes this value. And then this other vertex operator will just implement that you displace the D0 brain by this amount. So this implements this continuous transition from a static D0 brain to one that moves with the appropriate final velocity. And importantly, it precisely cancels the divergence. So to summarize what I did in this few more technical slides was, again, that we exhibited this one-loop annulus divergence, classical modification of the zero brain trajectory, which makes it move at a certain time, is not satisfactory. In the world line formalism, one explicitly quantizes the zero brain trajectories, and you find a very nice cancellation, and then there is a finite remainder which should contain the physical information. So now we can go to the case of interest for this talk, which is the case of space-time torus. So let's first look at the divergences. So now we're talking about closed string theory. So instead of an annulus diagram that diverges, we will have a torus diagram that diverges, but it's still a one-loop diagram in space-time. There is a very similar plumbing fixture construction where you can view the torus as a sphere with an extra handle added. You can cut open the path integral in this handle, insert a complete set of states labeled by alpha, and sum over this set of states. What you find then is for the leading contribution in the regime where the torus develops a very long, thin handle is the following expression, where epsilon is again cut off on the modular parameter. And if you compute this, you find that it again diverges with a square root as a square root log epsilon. So again, naively applying the standard perturbative string theory recipes would give you a failure, namely this one-loop divergence. And, well, the intuition could be similar as before. If you have a finite space, and if you were to add some energy to it, this would make your space expand, behave non-trivially, so it would tend to deviate strongly from what you thought was the background you started from. So the lesson we took from the zero brain story, namely that if there is an infrared divergence, one can try to integrate over the massless modes that were causing the divergence. And by the way, this is very similar to what one does in the study of solitons, where you introduce collective coordinates to cure what would otherwise have been an infrared divergence. So taking that lesson, we're going to do something very similar now for the zero modes that caused infrared divergence in the closed string case. What are these zero modes? Well, they are just the uniform modes, so the spatially homogeneous modes of the metric and the other massless fields in the theory, namely the dilaton and the B field. And I will, for simplicity, mostly focus on the metric on my slides. So here is the metric. Now there are there's diffeomorphism invariance, so we can choose some gauge which sets the 0,0 component to a constant and which sets the 0,i components to 0. And what is left, you then recognize as a degrees of freedom that are often used in quantum cosmology when people discuss mini superspace models. So our logic forces us to integrate over these homogeneous metric modes similarly to what people do in mini superspace cosmologies. So let's try to do that. Now, in mini superspace models, the main complication is time reparameterization invariance, so some remnant of diffeomorphism invariance. And this gives rise to the Hamiltonian constraint. And the type of observables that people then often introduce is as follows. You define an amplitude for the universe to have some spatial section g1 and to also have a spatial section g2 at some different time. But you don't get to specify the precise times at which the universe has to have those sections. Because of time reparameterization invariance, you have to integrate over the duration of the experiment, so to say. And if you do this, you get gauge invariant observables. And what we will do in our string theory context is do something similar to the zero modes, but then merge this with a string amplitude to get something that can describe scattering of strings in such a background. So here is the proposal. We will fix an initial spatial metric, a final one. And then there are a number of vertex operators that tell you what are the closed strings that that are scattered in the process that we are studying. This is a simplified version. I will comment very briefly on what you could try to do more rigorously if you want to get rid of vertex operators. But let's first give you the simplified version of the formalism. So in this integral, well, we integrate over the duration as one does in mini superspace cosmology. This is completely standard. There's the path integral over the homogeneous metric modes. There is an action for the metric modes, which you can think of as the Einstein-Hilbert action reduced to homogeneous configurations, and then there will be stringy corrections, but we will always focus on situations where this background metric can be treated semi-classically and where the curvatures are small compared to the string scale. So for practical purposes, for this talk, we can think of this as the standard mini superspace actions. And then there is the stringy part of the amplitude. So this would be a path integral over the string world sheets. This is the usual action for a string in the background field. And these are the insertions that give you the external string states. So as I said, we will focus on choices for G1 and G2, for which the integral over the metric can be treated semi-classically. So roughly speaking, this will mean we start with a big enough spatial section, and we end with a big enough one, and the classical solution should not be singular. And then there's also this integral over T, and we will also focus on situations where this integral over T can also be treated in a semi-classical way. And this will, well, a necessary condition will be that the duration of the experiment will be large compared to the string scale time. So those are the amplitudes for which I'll give a prescription for how to compute them. There will be more general ones which, for which semi-classical techniques will not help, and in that case, I don't know what to do. So just to reiterate the same thing with a few formulas, we will expand the homogeneous part of the metric around the classical solution that interpolates between G1 and G2. So this will be the fluctuations. So this tells you that you have a classical solution, and these are the initial and final conditions. So we will act perturbatively in small fluctuations of the metric and in fluctuations of the duration of the experiment around the saddle point value, which I call T bar. And we will assume that G bar is weakly curved and that T bar is large compared to the string scale. So you can ask, well, if I'm going to impose that the background has to be weakly curved and the duration has to be large compared to the string scale, am I not just doing low energy field theory in disguise? Couldn't I just have done Einstein gravity, for instance? Well, the answer to that is no, because the external string states are still allowed to have stringy energies and momenta. So this is the analog of doing scattering at a string scale in flat spacetime. Just now we'll do it in a slightly curved spacetime. So this is still very non-trivial compared to just doing low energy gravity. And by the way, to come back to the physics motivation, one of the questions you can try to address in this case. So one of the questions in string gas cosmology is, well, if you start with this initial state with winding strings and then it becomes a bit bigger, will strings annihilate or not? And in principle, to compute annihilation rates like that, you would need to do something stringy, for instance, some amplitudes like this in this compact spacetime. So this could be one specific computation one might attempt to do. Okay, so I will briefly flash the result for the torus amplitudes, still in this simplified setting with vertex operators. And what you see is a similar structure as before. There will be some saddle point value of the mini superspace action. There will be some fluctuation determinant around it. There will be the world sheet path integral, which is very familiar in string theory. And then there will be, well, this is the torus. And as before, you can write a torus as a sphere with two extra vertex operators and then some propagators that connect the extra insertions. So here are the two additional vertex operators. So for the diverging piece, these will be vertex operators for homogeneous metric modes, for instance. And then this is the propagator. And we're again going to focus on the infrared part of this, which means that we're going to look at small values of the modular parameter Q, which is now a complex parameter. And if you do that, you find that you get an expression like this, where epsilon is the infrared cutoff on the modular parameter. So, but the main point is that you get this structure with two extra vertex operators and then something that can diverge in the infrared as epsilon goes to zero. Now, the first thing to notice is that if G1 and G2, so the initial and the final spatial part of the metric, are chosen generically in such a way that the saddle point duration of the experiment is finite, then nothing is going to diverge here. And the reason is quite simple. We will have a sum over the conformal dimensions of the operators. And in the simplest case we had before, these conformal dimensions for a homogeneous metric mode would be like omega squared, where omega is the frequency. And if you have to integrate 1/(ω² over omega, you find a divergence. But here, we're looking at a finite time interval. The length is set by T bar. And we have a Dirichlet boundary conditions because the initial and the final value of the spatial part of the metric are fixed. So we're doing a Dirichlet problem on a finite time interval. So you don't have a zero mode. So you only have non-zero modes. So the integral here will be finite. It can grow with T bar, but it's going to be finite. So generic amplitudes like this, to the extent that they're semi-classical, can be computed, will not be infinity. So now we introduced a cutoff anyway. I mean, I could have done without this cutoff if I was interested in just generic amplitudes, because even without a cutoff, nothing would blow up for the reason I just explained. But we introduced this cutoff anyway to be able to explore what happens if you tune the initial and the final spatial metric in such a way that the saddle point time becomes large, because then you would restore the infrared divergence. And then the hope is that this divergence would get canceled against a divergence that we get on the sphere from integrating over fluctuations of the homogeneous metric components. So here is the sphere amplitude. So what I want to argue is that from this integral over the homogeneous metric modes, we will find the structure that we had before, namely the sphere amplitude with two additional vertex operators and some propagator added to it. So the way to see this is as follows. This mini superspace action, this would be the quadratic action in the fluctuations. So this you can view as some sort of kinetic term, for instance. And this fluctuation of the world sheet action, if you vary the space-time metric, would be of the form gamma times dx d bar x or something like that. So here is one gamma in the exponent, and here are two gammas which we can use to contract the two gammas here. So we bring down two factors of this. We contract them using this action for gamma. And in that way, you find a structure like this, where you recognize here two graviton vertex operators. And here, you find the green function. This green function can be decomposed into that is the Dirichlet green function, so it can be decomposed into eigenmodes of the Dirichlet problem. And the final result is then this expression, which looks very similar to what we had for the torus amplitude. In particular, we have the original vertex operators, but we also have these two additional vertex operators for homogeneous modes, and we have this structure of 1 over the conformal dimension. This is the analog of 1 over omega squared. So let me now tell you what we get when we add up this sphere and the torus diagram. So again, to say what we're doing, we're focusing on those amplitudes that allow a semi-classical treatment. So G1 and G2, we choose them such that the saddle point metric is weakly curved and the saddle point duration is large. Then generically, as I explained, such amplitudes are infrared finite because there's no zero modes on a finite time interval if you work with Dirichlet boundary conditions. And the remaining question is then what happens for very special amplitudes where you tune your initial and final value of the spatial metric such that it would take a very long time to go from one to the other semi-classically. So in that case, what we find that the contributions that depend on the cutoff, so on the one hand, the cutoff on the modular parameter of the torus, on the other hand, a short distance cutoff on the sphere world sheet, those cutoff dependent pieces have the right structure to exactly cancel each other. But there is something left, which is a cutoff independent divergence that remains. Now, the fact that something remains here, whereas in the case of the zero brain recall, everything canceled, is something that one can also intuitively understand. It would also happen if you had a free non-relativistic particle. And the reason is the following. We are working with Dirichlet boundary conditions. So we're fixing the metric at some time zero. We're fixing it at some time t bar. And if I then plot just in the analogous system of a free particle, the Dirichlet green function, well, you know it has to have, if I plot g of t, t prime, then at time t equals t prime, there should be some kink. And otherwise, it will be linear. And it's obvious if you're going to look at some finite values of t and t prime, if you take this interval to infinity, that the value of this Dirichlet green function will blow up. And that's precisely the divergence that we're still left with in special cases where the saddle point duration of the experiment becomes very large. So one can ask, is there, yes, thank you. One can ask, is there a way to define other amplitudes, not imposing Dirichlet boundary conditions on the spatial slices, but do something else? And that's something we are not sure about, whether there's something straightforward one can try to do there. I mean, for the case of the free particle, it's easy to do it, that you just define your initial states in a different way that don't depend on zero or capital T, and then everything is fine and divergences cancel. We don't quite know how to do it for the metric case. Okay, there's one loose end that I wanted to say a little bit about, and that is the fact that, well, I started this talk saying that if you have an S matrix, then your world sheet will have semi-infinite tubes, and then you can use a conformal transformation to transform those to closed world sheet with some punctures and local vertex operators. In our case, we don't have asymptotic regions, so this will not quite work. And this is a bit analogous to what people encountered when they tried to ask a different question, namely, in simple Minkowski space, can we define finite time propagation in string theory? And this turned out to be a very hard problem, perhaps surprisingly, but that's the case, and which has never been fully resolved. But one of the proposals at the time, among others, was by these people. And what they did was saying, well, instead of working with local vertex operators, let's just keep the loops describing initial and final string states. And then you can write down a formula like this, where you have to integrate over all the possible ways that you can embed the world sheet loops in the space-time. They were not able to really compute this in generality. There were some special cases where they could make some progress, and these special cases then later turned out to be related to the instantons. But anyway, there is some proposed formula, but not much progress later on to really get this to work completely. But anyway, since this formula exists, so we can use it in our context, so more precisely than for vertex operators is the following formula, where we don't have vertex operators, we still have an initial and a final spatial slice, and we would specify a number of loops that specify the initial incoming strings and a number of loops on the world sheet that specify, well, number of holes in the world sheet that specify the outgoing strings. And then otherwise we would have a very similar amplitude that we have before. And the issue of divergence cancellation is quite independent of this technical question of how to treat these diffeomorphisms, because one could ask the question for any fixed parametrization. You can see that, for instance, the cutoff dependent pieces will cancel. Okay, so it's time to summarize. So asymptotic regions are important for conventional perturbative string theory, as they allow for the definition of an S matrix. And by the way, the importance of asymptotic regions is also the case for more modern versions of string theory like ADS-CFT, as we saw in previous talks. If you extrapolate the conventional perturbative string theory formalism to compact spaces, you get infrared divergences at one loop in spacetime, so on a torus world sheet. These divergences are similar to annulus divergences related to the zero brain recoil. And for the case of the zero brain recoil, we now have a formalism in which it's clear that the annulus divergence is canceled by a sphere divergence that comes from fluctuations of the zero brain world line. So then we have defined amplitudes for a universe to transition from one spatial slice to another while emitting and absorbing closed strings. An important point is that the generic such amplitudes that can be treated semi-classically are infrared finite, so for those there is no worry. And then there are some fine-tuned amplitudes where there is still some cutoff independent infrared divergence, but this can also be understood intuitively as due to imposing Dirichlet boundary conditions on the metric. So I'll stop here, thank you very much.
Do we have any questions?
It's very interesting. I always thought that this was impossible.
Well, we'll see how far we can push it, of course, but
yeah.
It's an attempt.
I guess one concrete question is, there was some claim by maybe Susskind and other people that compactifying all the directions didn't really make sense, and I think it's probably related to these remaining IR divergences, you know, basically because you still have moduli, and the moduli are like massless scalar fields, and massless scalar fields are not a very healthy thing when you don't have when you don't have any non-compact directions.
Well, I think this refers to the original setup. If you do the standard conformal field theory, that's exactly what you get. These moduli are the things that run in the loop and that give you the infrared divergence.
Right, but I mean, they're kind of, I mean, there are still moduli in your case, right? Because you have a torus.
Yes.
And I think those are the things that are showing up in kind of your remaining IR divergences, you know, in these what you call these fine-tuned amplitudes.
That's a possibility. In the case, I think you could have said the same words about the zero brain recall, because there are also the Goldstone modes for the zero brain. And there it was clear that those divergences were there, but they precisely canceled divergences that came from a lower genus amplitude. In this case, some things cancel, but not everything. So indeed, I certainly take the point that it's not complete yet. So in a sense that for fine-tuned amplitudes, there is still something left. But I'm not sure if it's obvious at this stage whether this will invalidate the construction or not.
Hi, Ben. Is it possible that sort of calculations of this type could in the long run give you intuition why three dimensions might unwind, might decompactify in a string gas type scenario?
Yeah, well, the intuition for that is quite independent of this formalism. So the intuition for that is that, suppose a number of dimensions larger than three were to grow initially. So you would have lots of winding modes along all those directions. And if you're in more than three spatial directions, two strings will generically not find each other. So they will not be able to annihilate. So the winding modes will still there, and the effect of winding modes is to keep your spaces small. Momentum modes will try to make it expand. So if you're in three dimensions or less, then two strings will generically intersect. And in that case, depending on the details of how strong the interactions are, et cetera, but at least in those cases, there is hope. And under certain conditions, people have argued that it will happen, that they will find each other, the winding modes will annihilate. And in that case, there's only momentum modes left, which will make those dimensions expand. So that's the basic intuition that goes back to Brandenburg and Vafa in the late 80s. So what this could be relevant for is to compute more rigorous within string theory what the annihilation rates would be and things like that, for which people now usually use some more heuristic models.
Could you do this calculation when your spatial sections are, say, some WZW model, like a three-sphere?
Can I do this computation if the spatial sections are not the torus but the three-sphere, for instance?
Yeah, say a WZW model.
Yeah, well, we haven't done it, but I don't see a fundamental difference between the cases. I think the main part is that it's compact. That's what gives rise to large back reaction, even if you perturb it a little bit. So I expect similar results in that case, but we haven't quite done it.
Also, could you comment, like, for example, if I have a compactification where I have an internal manifold, say a Calabiau or something like that, and could, like, now people integrate that out to work in a low energy effective action, could you actually envisage a way of taking into account the effect of the internal space in a much more rigorous way using something similar to that, or is that too ambitious?
Well, okay, in the usual framework, for instance, if you have a four-dimensional Minkowski space times a Calabi-Yau, then there's nothing to worry about in terms of if red diverges. As long as you have a few large dimensions left, then you're all fine. And this is similar to what happens to D brain. So I discussed the case of the zero brain. So if you hit it, it will start moving and it will deviate very strongly from a static one. If you have a D2 brain, for instance, and you hit it, there will be some ripple that will disperse to infinity, but your final configuration will be very close to the initial one. Then there's an interesting intermediate case of a D1 brain. And what happens in that case, if you hit it and give it with a certain momentum, then locally, the D1 brain will get displaced, and then this displacement will spread out, and asymptotically, the whole D1 brain will move a finite distance proportional to the momentum that you gave it. So the analog of this would be having a 1 plus 1 large dimensional space. But if you have more than 1 plus 1 dimensions, these infrared divergences will not be there. The other way to see it is if you have 1 over k squared and you integrate it over dnk, this will be finite unless n is small enough.
If there are no questions, let's thank the speaker again.